All right, it is that time of the year. Candy canes, mistletoe, buying gifts for your loved ones, giving money to your beloved school paper. We're willing to go to great lengths to get your stories, so please support our efforts by going to mndaily.com and clicking the donate button. Give us your money.
Welcome back to In the Know.
Breaking down the used news.
We're your hosts.
Luke Diamond.
Mariah King.
And if this is the last you hear from us, you know we died during exam week.
Poetic or sad, you decide.
Just sad for me.
Yeah.
If you were to be killed by one of your exams, which one do you think it'd be?
Honestly, I'd probably just be crushed under the weight of procrastination.
Ouch.
Yeah, yeah.
The truth, it stings.
It's what I hear.
If I die, it's definitely going to be via my Spanish final.
Let it be known that Luke is in 1022.
I am. It's a beginner's levels class, but it's totally kicking my butt right now. And I enjoy Spanish. Ugh, world, it's unfair. All right. First piece of news, we had a very exciting visitor to campus this week. It was the probable, not decided yet, but probable, next president of University of Minnesota, Joan Gable.
This week, Joan is touring all five University of Minnesota campuses to speak with students and faculty, so head up to Duluth if you missed her here.
The University of Minnesota football team is in hot water. Six players are not going to be allowed to play in the next bowl game. However, it is not expected that this incident, whatever it is connected to the sexual assault case that's been unfolding for the past 2 years.
Wait, so why aren't they allowed to play in the game?
That's kind of anybody's guess right now. The only reason that has been given publicly is for undisclosed disciplinary action. So anything that can be contained in that phrase could be a reason.
Any other disappointing news on our docket, Luke?
Actually, yep. So we have one more piece of news left. A little bit disappointing. The Minnesota Student Association, aka the University of Minnesota Student Government, did not get any legislation passed last year. And so this year, they're headed back to the Capitol to rehash the same things that they tried to pass last year, but with a little more hope and, I'm assuming, oomph.
Can you say oomph again, just slower?
Oomph.
Wow. The sexual tension is palpable in this room.
But unfortunately, it won't be palpable for much longer because this is Mariah's last week at In the Know. Next semester, she's moving on to better places with better faces.
Here's to hoping. I have loved my time here at In the Know. Love the Minnesota Daily. I've grown so much as a person here, and I'm really excited to see where the next adventure or string of naps may take me.
Well, what do you say? Should you kick off your last episode?
Let's jump on in. I think Luke and I were talking about this, and we're thinking that we're going to kind of get your personal perspective on this rather than just the reporter perspective.
Yeah, sounds great. I got a lot of experience.
All right. So at what age were you diagnosed, and kind of how have you been managing it thus far?
So, yeah, I was diagnosed in eighth grade. So I can't believe I'm saying this on the air, but I'm 5'9 and a half. I weigh about 130 pounds. I was 5'9 and a half in eighth grade. I was a little bit bigger. I was like 139. And when I was first diagnosed, I was 99 pounds.
Dylan Miettinen is a general assignment reporter at The Daily.
My doctors actually thought I had an eating disorder at first because I was skin and bones. But my pediatric doctor called my mom. It was like 9:30, which is kind of weird. And she was like, we just got the test results. Like, you need to go to the hospital ASAP because my blood sugar was around 700,
what?
Which that doesn't mean a lot to a non-diabetic, but the typical range is 70 to 100. So 7 to 10 times, you know, normal people's. And that's when, again, your body just starts shutting down and your blood becomes acidic. It was very easy. Like, I very easily could have slipped into a coma at that point. The Minnesota Department of Health recently released a paper showing that young diabetics, specifically those age 18 to 44, were hospitalized, related primarily to blood sugar incidents, but then also incidents of mental health.
This piqued your interest. Why?
Because I am a type 1 diabetic. Diabetes is when your pancreas no longer secretes insulin. There's type 1 and type 2. Type 1 diabetes is where your pancreas no longer secretes insulin, so it doesn't really work at all. Type 1 diabetics have to monitor their blood sugars and take insulin for the rest of their lives.
What does insulin do for your body?
So insulin helps break down all the sugars in your body. So type 2 is when it doesn't really work as well as it should. It's what most people think of when they think of diabetes, where their grandparents may have it. Some may take insulin, but others may take pills or medication, and it can be more regulated based off your diet and exercise. Treatment for diabetes is a relatively new kind of thing. The cure, there's no cure, but the treatment for it, insulin wasn't invented until 1921. So like if I were born 100 years earlier, I wouldn't be here right now. It happened when two researchers at the University of Toronto broke down an animal pancreas, because the pancreas secretes insulin, and they were able to like extract cells and make insulin from that. So they ground up this animal pancreas, and it was a big novel thing that hadn't been invented before. And so they wanted to make it accessible to everyone. And so these researchers sold the formula for that to the university for $1. But then, because everyone was in need of this, they weren't able to keep up with the demand of it. And so they teamed up with some US pharmaceutical companies. And that's where problems kind of began to arise, because the companies were like, yeah, we'll team up with you if we're allowed to patent the formula for this.
Between 2002 and 2013, the price of insulin more than tripled to more than $700 per patient. Federal lawsuit accuses the three insulin manufacturers of conspiring to raise
the price of each insulin drug, Novolog, Humalog, and Lantus, has shot up as much as 400% in the past 10 years. Now, desperate patients are pleading online, saying they can't afford the insulin they need to live.
It's really difficult to replicate the formula for insulin, because insulin is composed of living cells, and there are just certain regulations in the U.S. That means that like there's no generic brand of insulin. So like birth control, for example, you can have, you know, your choice insulin, not so much. And because of that, some of these companies are really able to price gouge diabetics a bit. The cost of insulin has increased by 1,200% in the past two decades.
In the past 20 years?
Yep.
Do you know how much it is off the top of your head?
I do, actually. As a fun little way to just paint this picture of how expensive it is to be a diabetic. So Mariah, you had the unfortunate event to be diagnosed with diabetes, and you're uninsured.
Uh-oh.
So I hope you have a rainy day or emergency fund, because you are going to need it. So.
I have like a couple expired Chipotle gift cards. That's it.
All right. Diabetics need both short-term acting insulin, which is before you eat food, and long-term. The long-term costs $69.84 per pen. So going through four pens per month, that costs $279.36. Second one is a little bit pricier. This is the one you take before meals. That's about $95 per pen. In order to use those, you actually need pen needles in order to inject yourself. Those cost about 31 cents a piece. So you eat three meals a day, and then you have your one for your long-term insulin. You go through about 120 a month. Then you have a continuous glucose monitor. This continuous glucose monitor actually isn't covered by most insurances, so that's going to be out of pocket regardless if you are insured.
Oh boy. Okay, add it to the cart anyways.
And then you also need your reader to actually read your continuous glucose monitor. That's about $70 there. You have to go through three of those a month because they last 10 days. Those cost $75 a month. You can get a $20 little tester, but then test strips themselves cost about $1 a piece. So your first month of diagnosis will cost you about $984.25. And then every month after that, because you don't need a new glucagon pen or reader, will cost you $769.68.
That's more than I pay for rent.
Without insurance, diabetes is more expensive than rent.
That's correct. This is going to be the total for your first year as a diabetic. It'll set you back about $9,450.73. And that's not including the 3 to 4 endocrinologist appointments that are recommended as a diabetic, or specialty appointments like an eye doctor, which most endocrinologists recommend that you go through. So yeah, it costs you about $10,000 for the bare necessities to live. A lot of diabetics I've spoken with are kind of like, it has tangible impacts on how they choose to live their life. This was back in 2017, I believe. Alex Smith was just kicked off of his mother's insurance because he turned 26. He thought just for a while that he could go without insurance. And he went to the pharmacy, and for his insulin and test strips, it was a $1,300 cost just for 1 month. And he couldn't afford that. And so what happened is he was rationing his insulin, which one in four diabetics will do that at some point in their lives just because of the high cost of insulin and diabetic supplies.
26-year-olds are not supposed to die because they don't have insulin. But without insurance, Alex Smith couldn't afford the $1,300 a month to control his diabetes. So he tried rationing his insulin, empty vials found near his body.
And he ended up passing away 3 days before his payday. His last insulin pen was empty. I spoke with Alex's mother, and she is now a healthcare reform activist, which is really cool. She filed a lawsuit against several insulin manufacturers because stories like Alex are uncommon, but they're not unheard of. Alex kind of become the poster child for the high cost of insulin and the fact that it does have real impacts on people.
Okay, how old are you, Dylan?
I'm 19.
Okay, so is it safe to assume that you're still on your parents' insurance?
Yes, I am.
Like, have you begun thinking about that, planning for that? Is that something that's just, like, constantly looming?
Oh, always. I am so stressed out about it, even just going to the pharmacy every month, because you need three continuous glucose monitors every month. That's $75 out of pocket, because let's say you want to be a freelance artist. Maybe you can't do that because you need insurance, and so maybe you choose a more, you know, a more traditional route. Maybe you work in an office that has insurance, but you're not doing what you love. I'm going into journalism, which maybe isn't the best job market.
I don't think it's very lucrative, but
no. But I definitely know that freelancing is off the table for me.
How do you mesh your treatment with your school life?
It's definitely hard. You typically have a finger poke kind of thing. It's called a lancet, and so you draw blood from your finger. And then you have a monitor that, you know, checks your blood sugar. And then I also take shots once before every meal, once before I eat, even like small snacks usually, and then once at night.
So what about when you're sitting in class and your blood sugar's running high, you need insulin ASAP? Do you just run to the bathroom real quick? Do you hope that nobody wonders why you're shooting up in the back of the classroom? How does that work?
Well, it usually sparks a fun conversation.
I bet.
I know some diabetics who are kind of uncomfortable with dosing in front of others, and mm-hmm. so they'll just run to the bathroom. I'm kind of like, I'm a diabetic. I'm here. This is part of me.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. That's all for this week. Oh, wait, no. That's all for this semester. Thanks for listening.